Americans smile more, think more positively, and consume more antidepressants than almost any other nation on Earth. Yet, despite our reputation for cheerfulness, we rank only 23rd globally in happiness surveys. This paradox lies at the heart of Barbara Ehrenreich's exploration of America's peculiar relationship with positive thinking, a mindset that has evolved from personal attitude into national ideology. The book has become a cultural touchstone since its 2009 publication, resonating with readers tired of forced optimism and praised by figures from Jon Stewart to Oprah Winfrey. What makes this critique so compelling is that Ehrenreich doesn't oppose happiness itself. She simply questions whether our relentless pursuit of positivity might actually be making us miserable and, worse, blinding us to real dangers. As the 2008 financial crisis demonstrated, sometimes a little healthy skepticism is exactly what we need. My journey into the heart of America's positive thinking culture began with my breast cancer diagnosis. What should have been a purely medical experience quickly revealed itself as an ideological initiation. From the pink ribbon-decorated mammogram room to the surgeon's clinical announcement, "Unfortunately, there is a cancer," I found myself swept into cancerland, a place where medical treatment came bundled with mandatory cheerfulness. The breast cancer treatment path was largely predetermined: surgery followed by radiation and possibly chemotherapy, interventions that hadn't substantially changed death rates since the 1930s. Chemotherapy adds only 2 to 3 percentage points to survival rates for postmenopausal women, while causing months of debilitating side effects. Yet questioning this regimen or expressing fear was subtly discouraged. Most disturbing was discovering an entire pink ribbon culture had emerged around breast cancer. What was once a dread disease kept secret had become the biggest disease on the cultural map, complete with teddy bears, inspirational jewelry, and pink-themed merchandise. This culture carried an infantilizing, ultra-feminine aesthetic that contrasted sharply with the brutal reality of the disease. The unwritten rule in cancerland was clear: maintain a positive attitude at all costs. Personal narratives almost universally ended with upbeat messages, with little anger about environmental causes or the suffering caused by treatments. Even terminology was strictly policed. Victim became taboo. Those in treatment were battling bravely, and survivors were celebrated, while those who died merely lost their battle. Most troubling was the portrayal of cancer as a blessing or gift. Survivors frequently claimed they were happier now or that cancer was the best thing that ever happened to them. This transformation of tragedy into spiritual awakening effectively normalized what should be seen as a preventable disease. The underlying message was clear: your attitude determines your outcome, and negativity, not cancer cells, is the real enemy. In America, positivity isn't just encouraged, it's practically mandatory. The consequences for nonconformity have grown increasingly severe, with modern self-help gurus advising readers to get rid of negative people from their lives entirely. This creates a profound empathy deficit in our culture. Since Dale Carnegie's 1936 How to Win Friends and Influence People, Americans have been taught to simulate positivity regardless of their actual feelings. As more people became corporate employees rather than independent workers, these interpersonal soft skills grew increasingly important. Today, we're expected to be emotional wallpaper, dependable sources of smiles and optimism for others. Churches promote complaint-free congregations, distributing purple bracelets as reminders not to complain. Positive thinking advocates recommend avoiding newspapers and television news entirely. Jeffrey Gittimer suggests the internet will give you all the news you need in about a minute and a half. Alternative positive news websites offer only uplifting stories, ignoring global tragedies. This retreat from real-world problems reveals the helplessness at positive thinking's core, the implicit admission that some things can't be fixed through attitude adjustment alone. The only positive response is withdrawal into a carefully constructed bubble of constant approval and affirmation. The most compelling carrot dangled before positive thinkers is the law of attraction, the idea that positive thoughts attract positive outcomes. This concept exploded internationally with Rhonda Byrne's 2006 book, The Secret, which sold 3.8 million copies within months. Despite ridicule from rational critics for claims like food doesn't make you fat, only thinking it does, The Secret merely packaged insights from 27 existing inspirational thinkers. The coaching profession, which emerged in the 1980s when corporations hired sports coaches as motivational speakers, embraced this metaphysics because they have few concrete skills to offer clients beyond attitude adjustment. Their approach resembles traditional sympathetic magic, with visualization serving as an internal fetish. To appear credible, positive thinking claims scientific legitimacy through misappropriated concepts from quantum physics. Coaches invoke gravity, vibrations, and magnetism as mechanisms, though these explanations collapse under scientific scrutiny. Even quantum physics, with its uncertainty principle and wave-particle duality, gets distorted into the false notion that we are creators of the universe through our thoughts, what physicist Murray Gell-Mann dismisses as quantum flapdoodle. This solipsistic universe of positive thinking ultimately proves deeply antisocial, undermining the shared reality that makes human connection possible. Americans didn't adopt positive thinking because their geography naturally encouraged optimism. Rather, it emerged as a direct reaction against the oppressive Calvinism that early settlers brought to New England. This harsh religion imposed what could be called socially enforced depression, with its conception of an all-powerful, hateful God who had predetermined most souls for damnation. The faithful lived in constant anxiety, examining their loathsome abominations for signs of their spiritual fate, finding relief only through ceaseless labor. Elements of this punitive worldview persisted into modern American culture through workaholic tendencies and the glorification of busyness as virtue, particularly among the middle and upper classes. For colonial Americans, Calvinism's psychological burden was often unbearable, causing terror in children and religious melancholy in adults that sometimes led to suicide. The harsh conditions of the New World, with its hideous and desolate wilderness, likely intensified rather than relieved these religious anxieties. Only in the early 19th century did this gloom begin to lift, as expanding frontiers, economic opportunities, and intellectual ferment allowed Americans to reimagine their spiritual condition. Out of this environment emerged figures like Phineas Parkhurst Quimby and Mary Baker Eddy, whose meeting in the 1860s launched what would become the positive thinking movement. New Thought, as this philosophy was called, directly rebuked Calvinism by envisioning God not as hostile, but as an all-encompassing spirit or mind of which humans were part. This made sin impossible and disease merely an error of thought. The philosophy offered the thrilling possibility that humans could access divine power to control the physical world. New Thought proved particularly effective against neurasthenia, a debilitating condition characterized by back problems, digestive troubles, exhaustion, headaches, and melancholy that plagued 19th century America, particularly affecting middle-class women and clergymen. Conventional medicine offered no effective treatments and often made things worse through harmful interventions like bleeding patients or enforcing weeks of bed rest in darkened rooms. By the early 20th century, as scientific medicine began New Thought healing seem obsolete, positive thinking advocates shifted focus to promoting success and wealth. Yet positive thinking preserved some of Calvinism's toxic features: harsh judgmentalism, echoing the condemnation of sin, and relentless self-examination. The most striking continuity between Calvinism and positive thinking is their common insistence on internal self-monitoring. Calvinists watching for sin, positive thinkers vigilant against negative thoughts. This creates a curious self-alienation. One part of the self must work on another part, requiring endless rules, worksheets, and exercises for reprogramming. Achieving and maintaining a positive attitude demands constant, exhausting work, reading positive material daily, reciting affirmations, and obsessive self-maintenance that, ironically, echoes Calvinism's demands for perpetual self-examination. A vast industry has emerged to promote positive thinking, selling motivation in various forms: books, CDs, DVDs, coaching sessions, seminars, and merchandise emblazoned with inspirational messages. While individuals buy these products, particularly those facing illness, unemployment, or risky careers, the motivation industry's primary market is corporate America. Companies purchase motivational materials in bulk and pay five-figure fees to speakers, making motivation a multi-billion-dollar business. Salespeople naturally gravitate to positive thinking due to their isolated existence, cut off from headquarters, facing constant rejection, and needing to generate fresh enthusiasm for each new customer interaction. Despite their crucial role in persuading people to buy things they don't know they need, salespeople receive little respect. Norman Vincent Peale specifically ministered to this lonely man in the motel room, seeing himself as God's salesman. Through most of the 20th century, managers saw themselves as rational professionals trained in management science, reflecting middle-class faith that problems would yield to scientific approaches. Then came the downsizing wave of the 1980s, when companies began restructuring and eliminating as many jobs as possible. The corporate world shifted from loyalty to workers and communities toward a singular focus on shareholder profits. As corporations became mere aggregations of financial assets to be plundered at will, high-level managers realized they were as expendable as anyone else. Yet they had one advantage: stock options and golden parachutes that offered potential wealth amid the turmoil. This combination of danger and potential reward created a wave of giddiness among America's managerial class. Rejecting thoughtful professional management, they embraced intuition, snap judgments, and hunches. Business gurus like Tom Peters celebrated this shift, declaring, "Things are moving too fast for us to sort out logically what's going on." Corporate America embraced a wild array of spiritual practices: shamanic healing journeys, vision quests, Native American healing circles, Buddhist seminars, and firewalking. Between 1981 and 2003, about 30 million full-time American workers lost their jobs in corporate downsizings. With minimal safety nets, many formerly middle-class people tumbled into low-wage jobs or destitution. The motivation industry couldn't repair this reality. It could only change how people thought about it, recasting corporate restructuring as exhilarating change and job loss as opportunity. Companies hired motivational speakers for an ever-growing number of corporate meetings to manage change, a euphemism for layoffs and the increased workload imposed on survivors. Business self-help books like Who Moved My Cheese taught downsized workers to adopt a rodent-like approach. Don't analyze or complain, just scamper along to the next job. The actual layoff process became swift and brutal, with companies using euphemisms like releases of resources or career change opportunities. For the anxious survivors of layoffs, companies turned to team building, an effort to create fervent company devotion even as firms threatened to eliminate workers. The message was clear: a good team player is a positive person who smiles frequently, doesn't complain, and submits to whatever management demands. Most white-collar workers drank the Kool-Aid and accepted positive thinking as a substitute for their former security. Positive thinking promised them a sense of control in a chaotic world where the cheese was always moving. Though they had less actual power over their futures, they embraced a worldview claiming they were infinitely powerful if only they could master their own minds. While the Christian right gained attention for its fire and brimstone approach in the late 20th century, a friendlier theology was steadily gaining ground. Positive thinking is disguised as Christianity. By the early 21st century, this approach dominated America's most successful churches, especially the rapidly growing megachurches, which doubled to 1,210 between 2001 to 2006, with combined congregations of nearly 4.4 million. Instead of sin and suffering, this new theology offers promises of wealth, success, and health in this life. A 2006 Time poll found 17% of American Christians considered themselves part of a prosperity gospel movement, with 61% agreeing that God wants people to be prosperous. The key to manifesting this prosperity isn't prayer, but positive thinking. Sermons resembling motivational speeches focus on how to live a successful life, with encouraging phrases like, "keep a good attitude," and "don't get negative." Joel Osteen exemplifies this new positive Christianity. Though lacking theological training, he inherited and dramatically expanded his father's church to 40,000 weekly attendees and $1 million in weekly income. The Osteen's Lakewood Church, housed in Houston's former Compaq Center, resembles a suburban multiplex theater with no visible Christian symbols in the main areas. When the Osteens take the stage for Sunday service, they receive a standing ovation. The service features sophisticated production values, extremely loud Christian rock alternating with short speeches, all choreographed with changing colored lights and video screens. During one visit, the service celebrated Victoria Osteen's court victory over a flight attendant who had sued her over an incident involving a stain on her first-class seat. Both Osteens presented this as a victory for God's kingdom, with Victoria jumping for joy and declaring she had placed a banner of victory over her head. Though positive preachers retain decorative touches from Christianity, their theology traces directly to 19th-century New Thought rather than traditional Christian doctrine. The prosperity message particularly resonated with African Americans eager to transform civil rights gains into upward mobility. Harlem-based Reverend Ike discovered what he called mind science from New Thought literature and taught that poverty resulted from wrong attitudes while flaunting his fleet of mink-appointed Cadillacs. The business-oriented approach to Christianity begins with market research rather than theological principles. Pastors discovered people didn't want traditional church, but rather entertainment and services. They replaced hard pews with comfortable theater seats, interspersed sermons with contemporary music, and, notably, removed traditional Christian symbols like crosses, steeples, and images of Jesus that might intimidate or frighten visitors. These megachurches are typically designed to blend seamlessly into their corporate-style environments, abandoning the distinctive architecture of traditional churches in favor of secular-looking buildings that resemble suburban banks or school buildings. The pastors themselves increasingly function as CEOs, managing multi-million-dollar enterprises with hundreds of employees. They adopt corporate management styles, complete with mission statements, management teams, and consulting arms. The relationship between corporations and churches has become reciprocal. While churches became more corporate, corporations have become more church-like, with charismatic leaders claiming almost mystical powers. The result is a seamless world for churchgoers stretching from workplace to mall to corporate-style church, all delivering the same message: believe you can have it all, and if you don't, you have only yourself to blame. In 1997, Martin Seligman, self-described dyed-in-the-wool pessimist and grouch, was elected president of the American Psychological Association. Shortly after taking office, he proposed positive psychology as the theme of his presidency, the scientific study of optimism, happiness, fulfillment, and flow. Until then, positive thinking had gained little academic credibility, with intellectuals mocking Norman Vincent Peale and academics dismissing his successor's ideas as pop cultural ephemera. But Seligman's position and his ability to attract foundation funding changed everything. Suddenly, respected psychologists began producing academic papers linking optimism and happiness to desirable outcomes like health and career success, publishing in the New Journal of Happiness Studies. The media embraced this science of happiness, giving it magazine cover stories and regular newspaper coverage. For motivational speakers and self-help entrepreneurs, this academic validation was a godsend, allowing them to replace appeals to God or the law of attraction with the authoritative phrase, "studies show." Positive psychology's central claim mirrors that of positive thinking generally. Happiness isn't just desirable, but useful, leading to better health and greater success. Happy people do seem more successful at work, getting more interviews, positive evaluations, and career advancement. But this likely reflects corporate bias, favoring positive attitudes rather than any intrinsic advantage of happiness. The health benefits claim stands on shakier ground. While many studies show correlations between happiness and health, they don't establish causality. Several studies even suggest pessimism can be healthier than optimism. One found mildly depressed women live longer. Another showed optimistic children died earlier in middle age. And a study co-authored by Seligman himself found older pessimists were less likely to fall into depression after negative life events. The Templeton Foundation has been a major financial supporter of positive psychology, contributing $2.2 million to Seligman's Positive Psychology Center and about $1.3 million to various research projects. Founded by billionaire investor Sir John Templeton, the foundation is best known for trying to place religion on equal intellectual footing with science. Templeton himself was a devotee of Norman Vincent Peale and a minor positive thinking guru, writing several self-help books. By 2007, positive psychology was thriving academically, with over 200 colleges offering courses, sometimes called Happiness 101, including Harvard's wildly popular introductory course that drew 855 students. Yet beneath the success lay growing anxiety about the field's scientific foundations. At the 6th International Positive Psychology Summit, British academic Ilona Boniwell admitted that a lot of results are presented as stronger than they are, and the science of positive psychology has not necessarily caught up with the promise. These concerns erupted when Seligman himself announced to the summit that his theory of positive psychology was completely wrong because happiness is scientifically unwieldy. This created consternation among attendees, with some questioning how to balance empirical research with applications like coaching. The discussion ultimately veered from scientific concerns to branding and career opportunities, with one attendee suggesting renaming the field Applied Behavioral Economics because it's popular in business schools and goes with high salaries. As the first decade of the 21st century progressed, positive thinking reached unprecedented levels in America, with millions visualizing wealth, success, and material abundance. Yet, in defiance of the law of attraction, economic conditions were worsening for most Americans. The poor remained poor and even increased in numbers, with low-wage families rising to 25% of all families with children between 2002-2006, despite economic growth. The working class saw wages decline and decent manufacturing jobs disappear, while the white-collar middle class faced elimination of pensions and health benefits, job insecurity, and increasing income volatility from layoffs and downsizing. Meanwhile, wealth concentrated dramatically at the top, making America the most economically polarized first world society, even more divided than during the 1920s. The share of pre-tax income going to the top 1% rose by 7 percentage points from 1979 to 2007, reaching 16%, while the bottom 80% saw their share fall by the same amount, essentially transferring $7,000 from each household in the bottom 80% to the top 1%. While economic experts maintained nearly unanimous optimism about ever-rising housing prices and stock markets, ordinary Americans embraced a similar outlook that led to reckless debt accumulation. Robert Reich observed that American optimism explains why we spend so much and save so little, and our willingness to go deep into debt. The ideology of positive thinking encouraged this behavior. The Secret taught followers they could manifest material desires, while prosperity preachers like Joel Osteen insisted God wanted believers to have beautiful homes. Some religious scholars even suggested prosperity theology contributed to the subprime mortgage crisis by convincing low-income people that God caused the bank to ignore my credit score. The recklessness of borrowers was exceeded by that of lenders, as American corporate culture had abandoned rational management for emotional thrills, mysticism, and sudden intuitions. At Lehman Brothers, Mike Gelband was fired in 2006 for warning CEO Richard Fuld that the world is changing and they needed to rethink our business model. 2 years later, Lehman went bankrupt, with Fuld still wandering through his five houses, wondering how it all went disastrously wrong. Corporate leaders had ascended into a bubble of extreme wealth and isolation. between 1965 and 2000, the ratio of CEO pay to that of typical workers soared from 24 to 1 to 300 to 1. This lifestyle created what crisis manager Desenhall calls bubbleitis, extreme isolation where subordinates only bring good news, not honest reports. Steve Eisman describes the executive mindset as hedge fund disease, a combination of megalomania plus narcissism plus solipsism. When you're worth $500 million, how could you be wrong about anything? To think something is to make it happen. You're God. This is precisely the state of mind promoted by positive thinking gurus, from Mary Baker Eddy to Joel Osteen. Corporate chiefs had cynically recommended positive thinking to their underlings, but eventually came to believe it themselves, with the result that about $3 trillion in savings evaporated. Market fundamentalism was itself a form of runaway positive thinking, the belief that markets are self-correcting and need no regulation. Even Alan Greenspan eventually admitted his shocked disbelief that lending institutions failed to protect shareholders' equity. The market had achieved deity status, related to Mary Baker Eddy's benevolent, all-supplying universe. We've gone so far down the positive path that it now seems normative, the way one should be. We use positive and good almost interchangeably, creating a moral system where either you look on the bright side or go over to the dark side. Yet the alternative to positive thinking isn't despair. Negative thinking can be equally delusional. Depressed people project misery onto the world and imagine worst outcomes. In both cases, emotion distorts perception. The real alternative is trying to see things as they are, understanding that the world contains both danger and opportunity. Human survival has always depended on empiricism. Prehistoric humans couldn't rely on omens or supernatural reassurance that arrowheads would pierce bison hide or rafts would float. They had to be sure through careful study and experimentation. Though humans have been guided by superstitions and mystical visions, we advanced through practical knowledge, the strength of knots, sturdiness of shelters, sharpness of spearheads. The Enlightenment represents our tenuous understanding that the world unfolds according to its own algorithms of cause and effect, without regard for human feelings. Despite decades of positive thinking, realism persists. When stakes are high, we still turn to people who prepare for worst-case scenarios. Even optimistic Ronald Reagan invoked realism when dealing with the Soviets. Trust, but verify. In our daily lives, we all rely on defensive pessimism to get through the day. Drivers anticipate others cutting them off. We prefer doctors who investigate dire possibilities rather than settling on optimistic diagnoses. Even in relationships, vigilance is recommended. You may project positivity to attract someone, but you're advised to Google them too. Child rearing demands constant anxious vigilance. Visualizing potential dangers is how we've successfully reproduced our genomes. Critical thinking, inherently skeptical, remains the goal of higher education. Good students raise sharp questions and challenge authority, precisely what positive thinking gurus warn against. As surgeon Atul Gawande notes, whether fighting cancer or workplace problems, the key is actually negative thinking, looking for, and sometimes expecting failure. Positive thinking has served as a tool of political repression worldwide. In Iran under the Shah, Soviet-style communism, and other authoritarian regimes, forced optimism became a means of social control. American positive thinking differs mainly in being self-imposed rather than state-enforced. This burden can finally be put down. Vigilant realism doesn't foreclose happiness. It makes it possible. How can we improve our situation without addressing actual circumstances? Positive thinking dismisses real-world problems as excuses, but mind doesn't automatically prevail over matter. Poverty remains the most routine obstacle to human happiness globally. Happiness surveys consistently show the world's happiest countries tend to be among the richest. The economic meltdown should have undone, once and for all, the idea of poverty as a personal shortcoming or dysfunctional state of mind. Happiness isn't guaranteed even to the affluent and successful, but that doesn't mean we find it by journeying inward to revise our thoughts. The threats we face are real and can be vanquished only by shaking off self-absorption and taking action. Build levees, feed the hungry, find cures. We won't succeed at everything, but we can have a good time trying.